Okay, what do you say we get going? How about that? Is that good? Well, hi everyone. My name is Joe. Thanks for hanging out at this session. Glad you're here. I've been asked to talk about relational discipleship, and I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of our ministry context in Sarnia, Ontario. And like I said just a little bit earlier today, the things that I'm going to talk about or the ideas aren't necessarily a plug and play for wherever you find yourselves. But it might be, hey, this is how it's worked for us. This is how it sort of fleshed itself out. And it may encourage you to think up new ways of doing it in your context. So how I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to talk about it sort of in five layers. Talk about relational discipleship in team, those I'm closest to, in the leaders who are part of my church, in our worshiping community, in our neighborhood, and in our city. And like you, I've been to a number of conferences, and sometimes, let's be honest, most times I walk away feeling more depressed when I walk away from it than when I actually showed up, because the stories that we generally hear or talk about are ones of success. So what I'm going to do today is tell you stories on both sides. When I talk about leaders, I'll talk about where we've done very well, and I'm going to talk about where we really did poorly. And at the end of each point, I want to talk a little bit about those points, give you a chance for feedback, for question and response. I'll grab some of your ideas so we can make this a very collaborative time together. How does that sound? Good? We'll learn from each other? Good? So I want to start this morning with a quote from the TV show called The Wire. Anyone ever watched The Wire before? A few? Okay. So this is, I think, from season 4. And the character says this: a good churchman is always up in everybody's stuff. You're Anglican, right? So you can handle that, right? Everyone's shit, right? And that's how we do it. And in this particular scene, it's a minister or it's a deacon at one of the local churches. He walks into the boxing club where the guy who coaches boxing is helping these kids, and there's so many stories woven in together. And when he comes forward and says this really speaks to actually our work as church leaders, those of us who are on teams that lead churches. We sort of need to be in everybody else's stuff, which usually is the complete opposite of how we're programmed, or at least how we're taught to lead. When we planted the church in Sarnia, we started with, there was three of us, myself and two others. And my recommendation always is that if you can start in team, that's always the best way to go, because you can share the load, you can capitalize on each other's strengths and weaknesses, and roll from there. The trouble with that is that you cannot be a dictator when you lead in team. You can't always get your way. You can't always, sort of impose your thoughts and your feelings and your beliefs. But what we've tried to do, and again, done it well in some sections and done it poorly in others, is to not really hide anything from each other, but truly be able to submit to each other, be vulnerable to each other as we try to lead and do these things together. It's risky, but when we win together. When we lose together. So I want to talk to you about a challenging story that we had, and this goes around our kids ministry. Here's a shot of one of our worship gatherings. At the front of our building in our worship space, we have a whiteboard wall. It's whiteboard wallpaper, and we stick it there, and we use it for various things as a part of worship. And one of the things we do is that we'll often give kids just a handful of whiteboard markers, and as we sing the songs, we ask them to draw the things that come to mind, the things that they hear, or to express themselves in worship in that way. Here's a shot here from one of our Christmas gatherings a while ago. Sort of have the manger scene, I guess, happening here. Whatever this beast is here is saying, "Ner." And this one here looks like maybe part cow, part deer is saying, "Womb." Not moo, it's more of like a womb. And then to the right, you'll notice a cross between an owl and Frosty the Snowman, sort of making himself part of this Christmas scene. So when it comes to leading in team and to be intimate in that way, one of the very first hires we ever had at the story was to hire someone to help us out with our kids ministry. We had got $5,000 from our movement, which is a heck of a lot of money, very enticing for people to come and help you that way. And it was a very part-time role, and we hired somebody who was part of our community. Now, my huge fail was this. Prior to working in this church plant context, I'd worked at a large church in Calgary where I had staff, I had volunteers, full-time, part-time, and there was a certain way that you related or treated or led those types of staff members. And my huge fail was that I began to lead this woman who was trying her very best on a very limited budget and a very limited salary and very limited time to lead our kids' ministry, and I treated her like she was some person who had, you know, 10 years of experience, who was there full-time doing their thing. And things weren't working as well as we'd hoped with her work in the children's ministry. And I treated her in the wrong way, and I almost lost this relationship. I almost lost this family as part of the church because I was still leading in that other context where I am the boss, I'm going to tell you what to do. If you don't meet the appropriate goals, if you're not meeting those standards, we're going to have 1, 2, 3 letters, and by the third letter, if it's not all ship-shape, then you're terminated. And that's the way I walked in. It was this old, different type of mindset to leading relationally and in a way, to take care of your staff. But when we've tried to do things differently in team, it's had to flip on us. We've had to do things differently. So even though there are challenges, even though things don't always get done, and this isn't necessarily carte blanche to not do your job, we've had to move into this place of being in mutual submission, to distribute the weight, to be humble, and to give a lot of grace and a lot of space. One of the ways that we've done it in the past is being open with some of the hard questions with each other. So I'm not sure how it rolls in your particular denominations, but the evangelical denomination that I come from is, you know, when you are working in a place and someone is looking for another pastor or to fill a role, they might give you a phone call. They might woo you. And as the pastor, you sort of keep those things very secret, right? You don't want your church to know that you're kind of sort of thinking about doing something else. And then especially you don't want those who are closest to you, those who are part of your team, to know these kinds of things. So you generally hide that. And then once you've done the interviews and you've preached the call and all is set and whatever, then you reveal the secret. Aha, by the way, I'm leaving. So in the last 7 years of planting our church, I've not only had opportunities to go elsewhere, but I've also had this sort of gut feeling on the inside that I just cannot do this anymore. I want to go back to a normal church job with a normal salary without the pressures of planting and then just be done with it. But because we've chosen to do this discipleship thing relationally, because we've talked about being very intimate as a team, whenever a job offer has come forward, I've shared that with those who are in that 2 or 3 person team. And that's makes me very vulnerable at times. It makes it awkward. It makes you feel a little bit naked in front of your team. But at the same point in time, it's been one of the best things that we've been able to do, because all of a sudden then it's not about Joe advancing his career. It's not about the story, you know, having to figure out who's going to lead them. But if we're really in this together as disciples and not keeping secrets and being vulnerable, mutually submitting to each other, then it just sort of changes the playing field. There isn't the pressure, there isn't the secrecy, but it's more of, okay, well, let's discern what's best here for Joe, and let's discern what's best here for the story. So now I want to open it up to you as a team, or talking around inside of your team. What about what I've just said, good or bad, makes you feel good or makes you feel awkward? Or perhaps there's been a situation in your context where this has worked or where this has failed miserably. Let's take the next 5 minutes or so and do some question and response around this idea of being intimate with those who are very close to you in your team and relationally living out discipleship. Thoughts, questions, feedback. John.
In an anchor context, yep. So the team typically is priests and wardens. Mm-hmm. And you have your rector's ward, which is selected by the priest, but the people's ward, sometimes the people on the team are the ones who really want to work with them. So
you can't pick and choose always? So tell me when that's worked out poorly for you, and maybe a quick story of when that's worked out well and surprised you. Do you have any?
Where it's worked out well is being in a church context, not really knowing people and having a conversation with someone and realize that, wow, that person has a lot of gifts and recognize that it's a great thing. How it's worked against is some possibly being quoted in with an agenda. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen anymore. churches does it?
Never.
Okay. Somebody else. So would is the tension then, you know, those who are trying to follow things to the letter of the law,
yeah,
and those who are just trying to...
Who are much more easygoing and whatever, and then, you know, we get that sort of tension. And so asking them to not be in either end and to come into the uncertainty and vulnerability of this relational model. What I think I read somewhere, you know, Jesus model, circle of friends type thing, is I think that's a real challenge for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
Who are part of the old system that maybe needs to be restructured.
Sure, sure. By the way, one of the people who's on my intimate team, we do this. We butt heads all the time. He's the freewheeling hippie. I am the organizer. You know, he says that, you know, Joe, your house isn't open enough. And I say, well, your house is like a men's shelter. I don't want to live in your world. He doesn't want to live in my world. But it is possible. And I think, you know, that's sort of helped balance each other out.
People to appreciate and value and try to understand one another's perspective.
Yeah.
How you feel?
And this is hard for me because I came from this world. I'm the pastor, folks. I went to school for this. I'm obviously very successful, and you paid me to be here. So listen to me as I expound to you. I've had to learn the hard way that to lead well and to truly disciple and be discipled, because I don't have it all together, I've needed to submit to people that I don't agree with. Yeah. It's true, and I'm not sure what your experience has been, but sometimes we feel as church leaders and pastors that we have to come off like I've got it all together, man. Like, I don't make as many mistakes as you make, and really, God loves me the most. But this makes you very bare to each other, and I think if we allow God to use those other people to help shape us, I think that puts us in a healthier place. And then I don't have to fake it either, which is nice. A couple more? Yeah. That's right, we were there. We were in our suits, you guys were in all your fancy clothes and stuff. We were really jealous, yes.
In the balance of, I've been a parishioner who always reminds me, and despite the fact we disagree on many things I truly believe, he says, don't start something that you can't see through anymore, which is a huge component to team ministries and any sort of new ministry where it's so frequently dependent upon that ministry team.
Yeah.
How do you find the balance between, you're talking to yourself about being open with your team about possible calls and location?
Yeah. Right. See, and that's why we've tried very hard to separate what the story is from who Joe Manifold is. So I learned very early on in ministry that I'm doing my best to work myself out of a job. Like, I'll play my part in the church, but at the end of the day, I want the elders and those others who have pastoral gifts and those who have hospitality gifts to take on and say, whoever is sitting around this table, especially this table right here and this one here, it is you are in charge of moving this, helping move this church forward, keeping it healthy. God's called me to play a part today, and I might not be here tomorrow. So this has to be bigger than me.
What we knew is the traditional.
Yeah.
For this to happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it has to be that way, or else we develop, you know, personality cults, and that doesn't go anywhere. All right, keep this in mind. Let's move quickly here to the second layer, and I want to talk about who rules the world, disciples who disciple. And around this sort of leadership track of relational discipleship, I want to talk about those, and in my context, they're either board members or elders. These are people who are selected or they are voted in to help lead the church. And the way that we have sort of rolled this out maybe has been a little bit different than some of our predecessors. And I'll tell you a story quick. There was a young man who was part of my youth group back in the late 90s who ended up coming to our church and becoming one of our very, very first board members. So at 17 or 18, came out of totally a non-Christian context, you know, fell in love with Jesus, gave his life away to Jesus. Fantastic, beautiful. We start the church, he's on board, he's one of the most generous people I know. He would give anything to anybody. He's part of our initial leadership team. A few months into that, he begins a relationship with somebody. They move in together, they start sleeping together. He's very open with me, confessing these things. And at the end of the day, he says this. He says, "Joe, I love the church, but I want to be in a relationship with this woman. And you know what? I don't really have a problem if I'm sleeping with her or not. So if you have a problem with that, Joe, I love you, man, but that's more your problem. That's the church's problem. For me, myself, I don't see that as an issue." So I had to say to him, "Listen, man, like, I love you, and I desperately want you to be a leader on this team. But according to the way we operate, the way we see the scriptures, to the way we govern our local body, to what we fall under with the Free Methodist Church of Canada, you can't be in that type of relationship. We would see that as an inappropriate relationship. Do we want you to be part of the church? Absolutely, absolutely. But I would say that you are intentionally putting yourself in a position that will press pause on your leadership for now." And he said, "Okay, Joe, I get that, I understand it. I will submit to that." Great. So I told that story once at a Bible college, and there's a girl, I think she was in her second or third year, and she raises her hand and she goes, "Well, what did you do to enact church discipline on that man? How did you show him that he was wrong? What things did you do to, you know," and basically she said, "you know, excommunicate him from your community?" And I said, "We did the exact opposite, actually. To be honest with you, we've pulled him in even closer." And sometimes for us, when we get to this level here, and you know, people fail and they make mistakes, our first reaction is, "I am going to remove myself from this person, or I'm going to remove them from our situation. And that'll show them, and then maybe they'll come back groveling, get their stuff together, and they can be back on leadership again." That just doesn't make any sense to me. Why would we push them away? We've pulled them in even tighter. So that's a story that has worked well for us. And here's a gathering of some of our leaders who are in my backyard for a barbecue. And you know, it feels good. It works. You know, for the most part. The tough part is, though, that sometimes these people are not in sync with these people. Surprise! Like, that's ever happened to you before, right? Here's a picture of our most recent Christmas gathering. So what we do is we have this like baby, it's like an upright grand. We throw it into the middle of the room. We give everyone a Christmas carol sheet. We project a crackling fire onto the screen. And we sort of have this like old-time Gaithers stand around the piano and let's sing Christmas carols together on Christmas morning. And it's one of our favorite times together as a community. And I remember a few years ago leading up to our Advent and Christmas series, these people, whom I am part of, brought up to these people and we said this: "Well, wouldn't it be amazing if we kind of sort of canceled Christmas this year?" And they looked at us and said, well, what do you mean? "Wouldn't it be awesome that for all of us as leaders and as a church, we directed our people and said, what if we don't buy presents for anybody this year? Instead, let's take those resources, let's use them for something else, and you know what? Maybe we can set up a Sunday gathering where we have some stations where, you know, you can either make something for family members and that kind of thing." And the pushback was so hard from these people to those people that it was crushing. We walked away from that board meeting saying, "Why are we even doing this? What is the point? We're saying, let's try to do things differently. Let's really face into this culture that we find ourselves in. But they're like, no, we're not gluing macaroni to a construction paper and passing that off as a Christmas gift to our kids. And that was hard for us to take, because in a way we were a little bit ahead of our leaders, but at the same point in time we weren't in sync together. Will Willimon and Stanley Hauerwas are speaking of the situation when they say this. He said, we would like a church that again asserts that God, not the nations, rules the world, that the boundaries of God's kingdom transcend those of Caesar, and that the main political task of the church is the formation of people who see clearly the cost of discipleship and are willing to pay that price. So we have entered into an intimate discipleship relationship with these people because these are the people who shape these people. For us, we want to spend a lot of time, we want to help spend time shaping the shapers. Sometimes it works. And so we say, listen, man, we have to press pause on leadership, but we love you and we're going to pull you in even closer. Hooray. Other times when we say, listen, let's buck Christmas this year and do things in a different way that says Caesar is not in control and there's hard pushback and it's crushing. For us, it's this long-term thing where, you know what, we need to spend some time investing in those who are shaping our community. So let's spend 5 minutes talking a bit about that. What do you like? What do you not like? How has it worked or not worked in your situation? Yes? In what you're saying, like you're going to try stuff, it may work, it may not work, or these people think this is a good idea, those don't. Well, let's try it. What's the worst that can happen? It doesn't work. Okay, let's try the next thing. I think sometimes we get so afraid to try some of those things or experiment with new things, we're just locked down by fear, and then nothing happens. And then what's the point of doing it in the first place? Yeah. Sure.
And then I have a conversation that I have to manage within it, the micro leaders, they haven't gotten along. I'd like them on board. These ones are not interested in really doing what they said. They don't think they expected anything to happen.
Yeah. I don't have an answer to that one, sorry. It is, but I feel like, and this is just my personal opinion, I feel like these people here, part of their biggest role is to be good influencers around people here. That might be the biggest part of your task, is to win these people over, or at least purchase enough credit chips that they let you try stuff without crushing them. Last call on this one, yes. Sure.
Their support. And they don't really understand this pioneer structure because they're so invested in the larger infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I think that might help my work and work of others might be more education. And I don't think that a person such as I, who works less than 20 hours a week doing pioneer work, could lead in that education process, could shape it. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. That was what we were just talking about. That's part of their responsibility is to really invest with those people as these people invest in those people. And I want to move to that real quick here, unless you had something really important to say.
Brilliant.
Okay, go.
I think the challenge for me in terms of leaders,
yeah. But I think you know what's funny, John, is that you say that, is that this one here, the relationship one, is way more work. And there's way more cost to this. But this one here is different. This is like you're sort of like a dictator. We're gonna roll with my idea because I'm the pastor. But this one here says, hey, we're doing this together, this is more important than just me, this is about the mission of our church, and it going beyond just who's sitting around the table today. So that was a good point, John. 2 points for you.
Very good.
Let's move to the next one. I want to talk about making it hard to be a Christian, disciples in formation, and specifically what it means to disciple within the worshiping community. I think perhaps for evangelicals, one of the biggest problems that we have had is that we've tried to shape our insider gatherings for the outsider. Not that that's a bad thing. But sometimes as we've moved in that direction, we've sort of lost our insider language, perhaps our insider values, perhaps the way that we see and operate. We're saying, if we can just be cool enough for those people, maybe they'll want to join us. And I think there's an error there. Do we want to reach out and connect with people that don't know Jesus? Of course. But there's also a layer of discipleship for those people who have committed to Jesus, who have bought into his kingdom, and there's a certain cost and calling to that. Dallas Willard says this to us. He says, we've made it way too easy to be born again, perhaps much easier than Jesus intended. When do we get to the point at which we accept smaller numbers of intensely devoted people rather than feverishly investing in filling auditoriums and stadiums with massive numbers of lukewarm Christians that Jesus promised to spew out of his mouth? But I am super guilty of this. And I remember the very first, when I first got ordained, you get that form in the mail and they want to know, how many people did you lead to Christ this year? I don't know, I was a youth pastor. The question was like, how many times have I been to Taco Bell? Talking to kids about Jesus. One of the questions was, how many people are in your worshiping services? And I felt like writing back, well, you should ask me how many times I've fielded a phone call at midnight. How many times have I been to this guy's ball game? How many times have I done this, this, or that? And when our measurements are off, then our mission is off. And I think that's dangerous. So one of the ways that we've tried to sort of correct this in our worship gathering is, like I said this morning, we try to create this sacred space where people are allowed to participate in the preaching of the word and you know, hearing it from their angle. So I want to show you some pictures. These are things that hang in our worship space outside, sort of edging like the front. And these are our rules of dialogue. So of course, in the middle of our gathering, middle of the preaching, there's time for question, response, and feedback. And there's a few values that we hold to that bring this forward. This is the umbrella of mercy. You can say whatever you say without fear of getting, you know, reined in or on. Love the other. So you might have your opinion, and you might be right, and they might be dead wrong, but at the end of the day, it's not about being right or wrong, but how can we love each other? Let's remember that. Keep that in focus. Next one's a math equation. You have two ears and one mouth. Do the math on that one. What should we be doing more of? The next one is water the conversation. Don't say things like, that's dumb, you make no sense, you have not thought this through. Say things that give conversations life and grow. That one's our get out of jail free card. So you can say whatever you want to say. At the end of the day, you're still all right. The last set is this. You have the grace to change your mind. And we've seen that sometimes in conversations. Somebody will start on this end of the argument, and by the end of the conversation, they've turned it around. And sometimes we were embarrassed about that. But now we're saying, it's okay. That's formation. That's right. This one here is, we're all students and we're all learners. This one here is, tell your story. It's one thing to philosophize or to quote somebody else. It's much better if I hear it from something that's happening inside of you. Keep the conversation on track. And then the last one is sort of open, if we haven't, if we haven't thought of one, there's room for it. The stories that I shared this morning sort of play into that, where people are allowed to raise their hand and say, I might disagree with Jesus on this one, or I don't like what Genesis is saying. Yeah. The dollar sign?
Is it a dollar sign? The second one? Under the umbrella of grace?
This one here is love the other. So there's like two people from embracing each other right there. See that there? Yeah. So, you know, we sort of, you know, give room for that. And, you know, and part of the language we've used is that we want to be exclusively inclusive. Not exclusive to keep you out, but exclusively saying we want to do our best to create a space for you to be included in what we're doing. We're not going to change who we are or not live by the kingdom's rules and values. But at the same point in time, we want to be on a journey with you so that these things can affect you the way they have affected us. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so when we started doing dialogue, wow, we had no rules, and that was very apparent. Sometimes things would go into left field, there'd be lead balloons everywhere, it wouldn't work, and we just sat down afterwards and said, okay, what do we need as guiding factors to keep this together and not turn into minestrone soup?
So that, you pulled that out of yourself.
We developed those on our own because they fit for what we were doing. Well, they're actually for sale, so if you want, maybe I can sell them to you later. No, they're free, but you can have them. Henry Nouwen, our good Catholic friend, says this. He goes, this is our vocation, to convert the enemy into a guest and to create the free and fearless space where brotherhood and sisterhood can be formed and fully experienced. And this is the shape that we want to give our worshiping community. That as you are a part of things, you don't need to have all your ducks in a row, or theologically, all of us don't need to be on the same page. Instead, we want to create this environment that Jesus and his Spirit can do the work that they want to do inside of each and every one of us. But it always hasn't been that great. So our space, we've opened it up and tried our very best to make it a communal space, well-worn. And on our front door actually says sacred space and community venue. So we open up our building to a variety of different events, whether it be exercise classes or concerts or art showings like you see here, because we want to contribute back into our neighborhood. So there was this one artist, actually a guitar player, singer, who had actually played a show in our space. And I remember him coming in one morning, and I could see there was sort of something, you know, different on his face. I could tell he was a little bit choked up, and I had found out later that, you know, he had, you know, broken up with this woman that he had been with for 4 or 5 years, and it was a very devastating thing for him. And he came and he sat, and he's like, you're very sheepish, right? Sitting on his hands. Do you guys have a Sunday morning, you know, worship kind of a thing, church? And I was thinking, you know what, I'm just going to be really freewheeling with this guy. I'm not going to pressure him. I'm going to make sure that he doesn't feel like he's being pulled in. I'm like, yeah, you know, we meet around 10:30. You can come if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to, but we're here. And he continued to ask, you know, two or three, you know, deeper questions, almost feeling like, hey, man, Joe, like, can you just invite me to be a part of this, right? But I was trying to play the other card, trying to be much more open and saying, ah, man, you don't have to come. It's okay. Church isn't about Sundays. You know, it was sort of like that sort of thing. And after he walked out, I'd realized what had happened is that there was an opportunity here that, you know, God had presented for me that I completely missed. Like, I was trying to create this free, open, you know, place for question without penalty, do whatever, easy going. And here's someone who was genuinely saying, I feel like I need to be a part of something. I have this hunch that maybe something you have is something for me. I really want it, but I missed the boat completely. So maybe we can take a few moments and talk about that. When it comes to discipleship in our worshiping community, what's worked well for us, what has failed, and maybe something that I've talked about has sparked something in your mind. Yes?
Come out of the evangelical tradition. One thing I found, started my ministry 25 years ago, is that we were coming out of the structure 25 years ago. People had times during the week in the life of a church to do different things. I mean, I come from a tradition where Sunday morning was church for believers and Sunday night for an evangelistic service. I mean, those days are long gone.
Yep. Permission is a good word too. Anybody else? Yeah.
We and then here. It takes a long time, right? And so some of the most successful moments of corporate worship means that, you know, groups of families are like, like 30 families now, you know, rotating basis, and they share dinner together.
Yep. You're adapting. You're talking about what he's talking about. That's right. And what you were talking about as well, post connect. Nick?
I appreciate what you were saying about missing what this guy was saying to you because you had something else going on in your head. And I think that's a tension for people who are in a pioneering situation that happened to me often, because you do have to have some kind of idea of what's going on, mm-hmm. but it's, I found it so easy to miss what God is doing and not mm-hmm. to detect it. And I appreciate your honesty in saying that. And it's tough, because I think that's always a risk that can happen, that we can miss the thing that God is doing that we probably want most, because our head's in a different space. And that mm-hmm. connection, you know, that sensitivity to, okay, God, what are you up to? I've got my agenda here, yeah. but what are you doing? Doesn't come naturally for me. So
true.
Thank you for being upfront and honest.
You're welcome. There's actually a Henry Nouwen story that goes along with that. You know, it's, when you know his story, you know, famous speaker, scholar, you know, he's teaching at schools and that kind of stuff, and he kept saying things like, man, I'm trying to write these papers and put together these great presentations, and I'm being interrupted left and right by all these people who have other demands and needs. Oh, and then I realized, oh God, that's my actual work. That's what you called me to these holy interruptions, and not so much about all my great planning. So, good connection. Last call, yeah. Yep. So key, because sometimes we get locked up in saying, man, I really wish what I could do what St. Paul's Bloor does. Man, I really wish I could do what Nick Brotherwood is doing. Man, I really wish I could do what John's doing in Brantford. But instead, what I hear you saying is, okay, God, you've asked me to play third base today, and third base is, I'm going to just be the catch-all for all the funerals. What are you asking me to do in the right here and the right now? And sometimes we feel like I got to plan something, I got to dream something up, I got to do something that's like national, that's exciting. And instead, God's saying, listen, I really need you to be there for those funerals. That's really important for the team right now. Please do it. And if we see that, like you said, as being part of our worship, being part of God's overall mission of restoring and redeeming all things, then I think it changes things for us. A couple more, neighborhood and city. With neighborhood, I want to talk about preaching to the future and to loving our neighbors. We've done our very best, like I said earlier, to use our worship space as a toolbox, as a gift back to the neighborhood. And in our mind, though, it's also part of our evangelical toolbox. How are we projecting, how are we presenting the good news? And sometimes we project it literally. So I want to show you a picture of the front of our building from 2 or 3 years ago. And on the first Friday of every month in downtown Sarnia, there's an event called First Fridays. And it's the arts and culture bit for the month, so all the stores are open late. There's music, wine, cheese, special art displays, stuff happening in the streets. It's fantastic. So we were invited to participate in this, but we don't have things to sell like the other shops. So instead, what we do is we throw something out there that makes people stop and think. So we created this installation, and it's called One of These Things Is Not Like the Other, and we cranked out that Sesame Street tune. I'll show these clothes. Do you remember that? One of these things. We played it over and over again for like 3 hours. And we put it together like this. So this was the first one. One of these things is not like the others. So when you see them all together, we try to come up with four pictures that make you feel awkward. When someone is picking their nose in front of you, the polite thing to do is to turn away. When you see a woman crying and the mascara going, for me, I'm out of there. I'm going the opposite direction. I know where that's headed. I want no part of that. Or if you walk into somebody on the washroom, not really a cool thing to do in our culture. You might just sort of back out and say, I'm sorry, sir. But for us in Sarnia, with our Aboriginal communities, it's the same vibe. So for us, the petrochemical industry sort of surrounds part of the three Aboriginal reserves that are in Lambton County, the county that our city is in, and the relationship is strained, to say the least. Sarnia has a tough relationship with its First Nations people. So what we wanted to put forward in this moment was, well, hello, folks, let's stop and look at this. Let's stop and think about this. Is there anything overtly evangelical about this? No. Did we mention the name Jesus at least once? Nope. Have anyone outside handing out pamphlets or inviting them to the Sunday worship gathering? Nope. Instead, though, I think we are pushing forward a kingdom value of what it means to love the other, maybe to love our enemies if we see them in that way, what it means to be kind and gracious and good and walk away with those feelings. So this is one of the things that we've done, that we did well, that worked out for us and was good. I mentioned this morning here as well. This was in the brochure from that art gathering that happens on our street. This was our ad in that paper for that weekend. The story, 24/7 and intentionally on Sundays at 10 a.m., except for Art Walk weekend. It wasn't like, hurry up, come to church. No, it was like, hey, we're usually here, but we're not today. So just so you know. John Tyson, who is a church planter in New York City, says this to us today. He says, if you're church planting, do not be the darling of the previous movement just because it's easy and you'll be successful. Embrace the pain of preaching to a culture that does not understand, that does not care, and that does not want to hear. You'll be a far greater use to the kingdom of God preaching into the future rather than preaching into the past, where it's easy to gather a crowd that's already looking for consumer tidbits. I've played that game. It feels good to me when a room is full, when people like to come and hear me preach, and it's sort of exciting. But there's something else for us as pastors and leaders and church planters to preach and reach and connect with those who do not care less, could not care less about anything we're talking about. This is the hard work of the kingdom. And I think part of the struggle for me as a pastor, and I'll be very transparent with you here, is that I want this. I want to be recognized. I want to be known. I want to be patted on the back. I want affirmation that I'm actually good and valuable at something. Because sometimes for us as church planters, there's none of that. When I worked at the big church, it was awesome. People want to have coffee with you. When we first planted, no one wanted to have coffee with me. There was a time where my email box was full, and that's because I had stuff to do. The first 2 years of church planting, I was like, what am I doing? This thing is empty. No one's talking to me. It feels weird. And then recently, as I've gone through some of my own struggles with, you know, continuing this church, we're not a church plant anymore, we're an established church, what does it mean for us to be healthy moving into the future? I've asked myself, well, what does that mean of me as a person? What does that mean for me as a pastor? And here's where I've really had to face in to my pride. I got stopped in the grocery store 3 or 4 months ago, and it's a woman whose kids come to our church, her daughter and her son-in-law. And they were going through a pastoral transition, and she sort of catches me off guard, and she says, oh, Joe, did you hear that we're getting a new pastor? And I said, yeah, I heard about it. Do you know him? Yeah, we've met before. You know what, I'm really surprised that you didn't apply for that job. So this is a big Baptist church on the other end of town. We're the little Methodist church in downtown Sarnia. And she really caught me off guard that day. And it stirred something in my pride so fierce that I've been sort of fuming about it ever since. Because I felt like this. People must look at me and say, what a poor guy. He couldn't make it anywhere else. He never got that good church posting. He's not working in a big city. He's in a little two-bit town, blue collar that is, in a really crappy downtown, and he's got this little tiny church plant of 70 or 80 people, maybe on a Sunday if you include kids and dogs and cats, you know? Poor Joe. Man, maybe one day he'll catch his break. And inside me, I'm just churning with anger, because what I'm saying is, I have chosen to do this. I could do those other things. Trust me, I want to do those other things. I would feel, my wife has talked to me about doing those other things. But I'm here on purpose. This is what I feel that I should be doing. But inside of me, I've still got this other bit that says, man, I really wish I could just pull the ripcord and go back to the easy church job, because that would be way better for my ego and way better for my bank book. So I've had to pull out and say, why am I doing this? Why are we here? Why are we doing these things? So let's talk about that a little bit here. When it comes to neighborhood, when it comes to preaching into the future, to those who may or may not care, what resonates with you, what's worked for you, what's failed, let's talk a bit about that. Yeah.
Continuing on with what you just said, I'm now curious, is it better to almost deprive some of our church, our pioneers, so that they have to work for it, so they have to be hungry for it, or is it better to have the established church model where you say, you know what, we've got all these wealthy resources at this one church, we'll send out someone on their own department? Is it, I remember being impressed last year when there was an Anabaptist minister that basically showed up in Toronto $10,000 in his family, and he had 2 months to make it work.
Yep.
And I thought, there's guts. And he worked for it, and made it happen.
Yep.
Are we too privileged to in some of the other churches?
I think I have two responses to that. Number one, I think that older, established churches have a responsibility to seed and help young and new communities. That's got to be part of their job. It has to be. It has to be. On the flip side, because it's been very lean for us, so our full operating budget every year is around $60,000. So that covers mortgage, whatever salaries there might be, crayons for the kids, lights, whatever, which sucks for me, and I'll be honest with you here, because the last church I worked at of 2,000 people, my salary was $60,000 a year, plus book budget, plus car budget, plus conference budget, and that was everything. So now we're operating all under that. So what that's forced us to do is be very creative with how we use our resources, what's most important to us. And that's just operating budget. What about when it comes to mission? So someone needs a bike, someone needs food, some kid needs a backpack, well then that's different money altogether. So I like being forced to be creative with that. At the same point, I think that older established churches have to step up and stop just caring about their own bit and backing new works. So I would play both sides of that. John? Well, I just put method because he had a question around method, but go ahead.
One way that we engaged our community was the church is situated in what once was an affluent community.
Yep.
And trying to get a backstory of what happened there.
Yep.
And I realized that back in the day, the neighborhood associations were a force. Mm-hmm. And then I called the city, I go, do we still have one? And they had been one for 25 years. So we started.
This awesome on Sundays, it's more like how can we be awesome for our community, which I think is more in tune with the gospel anyways. One and two, yeah. I'm from Toronto. Sarnia is the whitest city on planet Earth.
Yeah, I know. And so, I mean, that's, I'm not sure
yeah.
how we
Yep. Something to think about. Last one. Yep. Totally, which I think is so beautiful, because sometimes we felt like the church needs to be the man in this and run it all. And instead, what you're saying is, why don't we get behind what God's already doing, or at least help in those areas that need help in our community? So that's excellent. Last one on this.
Well, just to speak to that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it looks like a neighborhood is particularly, everyone thinks the neighborhood is particularly, and it's not. I worship at a church which seems to be in the middle of a rich neighborhood. It's very short walking distance to High Park in Toronto. And the last demographic study I saw of the parish neighborhood is that it's below the Ontario average.
Mm. Examine the context, learning the story. Right on. Last section right here, because I want to get you off here on time. David Fitch, whom, if you have not read his book, The Great Giveaway, written in 2005, you need to do it. It was formational for me and really helps wrap your brain around what it means to plant new churches in new contexts. He says this. He goes, the church must be present as Christ in the neighborhoods. That's what you were just saying right there. It must gather to be present among the hungry and the hurting, however that might look. This means the practice of the church must be decentralized in its organization, away from one central place to being present in the everyday lives of people. So for us, as it's come to the city, our strategy has always been to lay low, as in we don't advertise, we're not in the paper, we're not doing events to attract spectators. For us, it's been a bit hard to get connected with our community. You have to know someone or be brought by someone or accidentally stumble upon the place if you're downtown. The fancy word for this for us would be we were trying to be incarnational, though. So instead of inviting people to this thing that we're doing, we're saying, what does it mean for us to bring the good news to the relationships and the contexts and the people that are already part of our lives? What does it mean to do God's work where it needs to be done? So one of the things that, and I want to share a story here of where it's been done well, is that there's people in our church who are part of this program called the Circles Program. Anyone ever heard of the Circles Program? It's about building bridges out of generational poverty. And you will go in as a family and become an ally to another family who is struggling or sunk deep into generational poverty. And for 2 years, you eat together, you support each other, you hang out. Long story short, a couple from our church really got connected with this single mom. Now here's her story. I've got 10 minutes total. Here's her story. She's a single mom, grew up in an abusive home, has two boys from two different dads. Both of the boys have severe temperamental issues. She was formerly a stripper, and now she's in a lesbian relationship with another woman. And the first Sunday that she was invited to our church was during a series that we were talking about gays, homosexuality, etc. All right, so there's seven big deals happening all at once. This is not your average good church type person who might come on Sundays. Anyway, she brings her kids to church. The kids are part of the Sunday school stuff. After that's over, the Sunday school teacher of the day brings me this picture right here. This was drawn by her son, Keegan. And she goes, you know what this is? And I was like, I don't know. She goes, well, I asked Keegan what it was, and this is what he told me. He goes, this is a picture of me killing my mom. And the kid's like 7 or 8. And I look at a situation like this, and I say, I have no idea how to handle this. There's already seven big hurdles that this poor woman is coming to or overcoming. This ends up in our Sunday school, and we still have, you know, traditional type people who are saying, Sunday school better be awesome. If it's not good for my kids, we're not gonna be here. This presents a bit of an issue, not to mention the chair throwing that this poor kid practices. But when it comes to us truly engaging our city, we found that the best work is done here. I'm saying that there is room for people who are not like us to be part of what we're doing. And connecting ourselves to things like circles exposes us to things and people and places that need to hear the good news in a very bad way. If our mission is to work towards God's ends, and that's the redemption and renewal of all things, these are the types of things and people that we need to busy ourselves with and immerse ourselves in. I want to share a quote. This is from a movie I saw this past weekend called A Beast of the Southern Wild. I think it's up for Best Picture of the Year. And the little girl, star of the show, says this. She says, the whole universe depends on everything fitting together just right. If one piece busts, even the smallest piece, the whole universe will get busted. And I feel like that's for us a picture of this world that we are a part of. But it also shows a picture of how good our God is, realizing that this one thing sets off this butterfly effect, and God says, all the little broken pieces, that's what I've come to redeem and restore. And I'm not doing this on my own. I'm calling you to be with me in it to heal, redeem, and restore your city, whether it's Keegan with his drawn pictures, or it's the board member who's sleeping around, or the guy who comes and really wants to talk to me about church, but I don't have time for it. To me, this is what it means for us to disciple our city, to be out there and be involved in all the broken, busted pieces. So let's take the last 5 or 7 minutes or so and talk about the city. What works for you with what I said? What do you disagree with? And how does it look in your context? Yes.
I found that the more time I spent in the city,
yes,
and building relationships with those groups, the more I found help for kids or adults like Keegan, because I already had a relationship with somebody who knew somebody who could get help.
Yep. Somebody else. I think you're touching probably all on the crux of it all here, is to be present in that. Like you're there. You're there. Last call, one more. John.
Sorry. I like the idea of your past as well. So often we'll go into
So with that in mind, and to summarize what we talked about today in regards to relational discipleship, at least this is how it rolls in Sarnia, is that to be in team, that sort of core, to be vulnerable, to be mutually submissive to each other, open, and transparent is and has been key. I think for us, we also have to remember that our leaders, our boards, our elders, our wardens, who are sort of on that next ring, these are the shapers of the shapers. So I feel for us, as the intimate and small core here, part of our big deal is to influence and disciple here, remembering that these are the ones who are helping shape and disciple those who are part of your general worshiping community. Remember, like what we talked about, it doesn't always work out perfect here. Sometimes it's, I hate Genesis and I want this book out of the Bible. And other times it's like, wow, I can actually ask a question about God in church without getting rained on. And keeping in mind also that God calls us, like was said today, to be an asset in the neighborhood, to learn the stories of what's happening, to examine, to connect with it, and to partner with what's already going on, to partner with what God is already up to and has already been up to before any of us ever showed up. And then the big picture, that sort of larger circle, is to recognize our work and our presence in the city. And it's not necessarily about doing the next big thing or being great or being recognized, but like some of us have talked today about being present with those who are musical, present with those with the funerals, and you would talk about what does it mean for us to turn our way out and look at our neighborhood and say, what can we do for these people? This, I think, is key for us. So I would like to pray for all of you. Is that okay before we roll? And before I even do that, super shameless plug right here. A lot of things I've talked about, we fleshed out and we put it together in a book. And there's liturgies in here, there's pictures, there's stories. Again, this isn't a how-to manual. This is just saying, this is how we have lived out part of this and our mission in Sarnia. And perhaps it could encourage you as you move forward. So if you end up buying a copy, it goes right back to the church to support what we're doing.
And are there quotes in there?
There is a heck of a lot of quotes in there.
That you had? Okay.
Yeah, many of those are in here. And before I pray, just two other things real quick. Someone who's doing this very well in your ranks is John. And I'm not just saying that because he's an Italian brother of mine. But we've spent time together. It's okay, maybe John, maybe in another life, maybe you'll be Italian. Who knows? That could be a good thing. John is really fleshing a lot of these things out. Like, these ideas are actually hitting the road in Brantford. So I would say talk to him. He's been a huge encouragement to me just to hear if this stuff is actually working in a Canadian context. And also, I just want to give a quick shout out to Mr. Nick Brotherwood, who's not listening to me right now because John is distracting him. John, thanks for coming to my session. I met Nick a number of years ago. And Nick, I heard you talk yesterday, and I wanted to encourage you that the work that you set up with Emerge way back in 2003 has helped lay some of the groundwork for people like me to do the things that I'm doing. So I'm very thankful for you. So what you've done isn't a failure because it ended sooner than you thought, but it set the driveway for us to drive through on it. So thank you for that. Can I pray for you guys before we go? God, you're so good. Thank you so much for these men and women who have listened to you, who have taken the collect call from you to plant the church and been obedient to follow you wherever it is that you're leading. God, I pray that you would resource, that you would equip them with the things that they need, that you would give them inroads in their neighborhood, that they could truly be present, that those who help lead alongside them, they could be transparent and open and vulnerable and submissive with them. God, may discipleship also take place on their leadership levels. May those people in their churches realize and come to grips with the fact that they are the shapers who are helping shape the worshiping community, outflowing of your work in their cities and in their contexts. And God, for those who are feeling low, encourage them. God, for those who are riding high today, may they spread that to others. And in all things, God, we just say thank you for including us in your work. May your kingdom continue to move forward. And we pray, as your son prayed, for the redemption of all things. And we look forward to the day that you finally set all wrongs to right. In your good and holy name we pray. Amen. Amen. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming out. Have a great lunch. See you later.